Welcome to Pit Pass Moto, the show that brings you interviews with the motorcycle industry insiders and racers who make the sport move. I'm Heather Wilson, a new host of the show, and I'm joined by Clint Esposito.
What's up, everybody?
How's it going, Clint?
Very good. How are you?
Good. I'm excited to be doing this with you.
Yeah, I agree. So today, what we're going to be doing for everybody at home, the fans, the current listeners of Pit Pass Moto, we are now your new hosts. So this episode, we're basically just going to figure out who one another is. Would you say that's fair enough?
Yeah, Clint and I just met last week, honestly, for the first time. And that's what's crazy about this industry is we've both been in it for so long, but there's still so many people that you've yet to meet. So it's going to be exciting getting to know each other on the show and interviewing the guest in the future.
Absolutely. So I'm sure everybody at home is sitting there going, why are you guys now hosting the show? So that's kind of what we're going to touch on, is basically our backgrounds in motorcycling and what makes at least somebody think that we were a good fit for Pit Pass Moto.
Yeah, we just kind of fell into this. And I think that we were both interviewed by the former host, Dale Spangler, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I had done the show probably only 2-3 weeks before me seeing him post that he was leaving the show and was like, is anybody else interested in hosting? So I actually had just sent him a message and I was like, I'm interested. Is it remote? Was my first question.
Yeah, same sort of deal with me. And shout out to Dale for laying the great foundation for this show and for giving us the opportunity to take it over.
Yeah, absolutely. He was way too happy to help. You know, most people don't want to help anybody, and he was very happy to help. So that's great to meet somebody like that. But once again, like you said, the motorcycling community is a little bit tighter knit, maybe. And that's why he felt, you know, like he would bequeath it to us.
Yeah, and I think...
Bequeath, does that mean that you died? I hope that doesn't mean you had to die.
The cool thing, too, is I think our backgrounds and our experiences within the industry are kind of different. So we can bring kind of different perspectives to the show and a lot of different guests that we probably have different connections with.
Absolutely. So let's get into it. What is your connection with the motorcycling industry, like from square one? How'd you get interested as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, I was kind of born into it. And I know a lot of people like to say that about things that they're interested in, but that was true for my family. My dad was an off-road racer his entire life. And after I was born, that just kind of came with the family, right? So he owns a motorcycle dealership here in Ohio. They're celebrating, I think it's 46 or 47 years this year. I should know that. But grew up in a family that owned a dealership, and my dad was always racing. We spent our childhoods going to the races with them, being pit support, riding dirt bikes ourselves, camping with the family. So that was really like my introduction to motorcycling.
Did you ever work at the shop?
I never formally worked there, although when I was like 10 years old, I could run the cash register like crazy. Like I knew how to do all that stuff. I can't even do that now. The most that I can do when I go in there is answer the phone and ask if I can put them on hold.
But direct their call.
I never did formally work there. Just kind of always went through, you know, school, and then eventually got my start in the industry with the Motorcycle Industry Council as a communication specialist after I graduated with a journalism degree.
Very good. So you have paper that says you can do this.
I guess so, yeah.
I have no formal qualifications.
Yeah, I mean, really, I knew I wanted to combine like my love of journalism with writing, with public relations, all that, with something that I was passionate about, and motorcycling just made sense.
So you were born into it. And now I know that other than writing, doing journalism stuff, you actually do motorcycle safety courses.
Yeah. So after I worked for the Motorcycle Industry Council, I worked at the American Motorcyclists Association. And then about 3 years ago, I started my own business called High Gear Success. And I work with a lot of motorsports event organizers and racers and companies in the industry. So that's like one segment. And then the other kind of piece of that is I do get to train people and teach them how to ride motorcycles here in the state of Ohio. So that keeps me busy, kind of two separate things. One's a little more locked down at the computer, and one I actually get to be outside sometimes and, not ideal weather conditions, but it's still fun.
That's what nature's all about, I guess, right? Surprises.
Yeah. And I actually, not this week, but next week, I will be teaching my first class of the year. And considering that we had snow here in Ohio yesterday, I'm really hoping the forecast takes a turn.
Yeah. That could be a frigid lesson, huh?
Yeah. That's not a fun time. So really hoping it warms up.
Yeah. I just came from Florida. And it was very disappointing that it was still cold when I came back. Even though I was only gone for 4 days, I was hoping something had turned. But
yeah, and you were down there for Daytona Bike Week, correct?
I wasn't. I was down helping my friend do car stunts at the Freedom Factory, which is in Bradenton, Florida. So he jumped a car about 80 feet into two cars stacked on top of a bus. And then knock the cars off of the top of the bus. And then I blew up the explosions when he hit, so it looked extra dramatic.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely a stark difference from the side of the industry that I'm on, where I'm always like talking about safety stuff, and then you're blowing stuff up and doing crazy jumps. So why don't you kind of like tell us about how you got started in freestyle motocross?
So my father was a Harley mechanic and stuff when I was young. He actually had bikes in the garage, but he had ironically stopped riding when I was a little kid. And somebody had left like a CB125 in the garage. And I was like, I want to ride that. That was the first thing I'd ridden with a clutch. So I convinced him to pull that out of the garage. He made me help him work on it to get it running so I could ride it. Then I raced motocross as a kid. And then I turned pro when I was 19. And then about a year later, somebody had called me about doing a freestyle show at a Monster Jam. So I ended up going and doing that. And then for about a year, I rode both. I raced and I did freestyle. And I decided I needed to pick and focus on one thing. And I went to freestyle because I was not fast enough to make the same money racing. So that was an easy decision there.
I mean, how do you make that transition between racing on a motocross track to doing stunts and flips and crazy stuff?
Well, I had already ridden BMX as a kid.
Okay.
So I had done a little bit of tricks. And even when I was real young, before freestyle was really out, I used to try my bicycle tricks on my XR100. And then once I would, I rode my whole life. I turned pro. I started doing half an hour motos and stuff. I would get bored. So after I did my motos, I would find the biggest jump on the track and do like no footed cans and knack knacks and stuff. And actually the guy that was booking Monster Jam called the guy whose house I was riding at, asking him to come and do the shows. And he was like, I can't do that. I have a kid and a business. But he goes, I do have a pro kid here that rides all the time and he's already doing tricks. You know, like I was messing around with it anyway, just for fun. And then, you know, I just started focusing on that more and trying to, you know, learn more tricks until eventually my big hurdle in freestyle was learning to flip, which I kind of felt like I needed to at least flip to get at least a certain level of credibility where you can't just be like, you suck. So I'm like, at least I did backflips for 10 years.
Oh my goodness. I tell people all the time, like they ask if I do motocross or stuff like that. I'm primarily woods rider. I like adventure riding, that type of stuff. So for me, the wheels don't leave the ground, at least not intentionally. I like to be grounded in that regard. And I can't imagine doing jumps or doing backflips. That's just crazy.
Well, I can tell you that there's no feeling like hitting a ramp. You know, at a big gap and getting launched off of that thing, you'll almost never get a dirt jump that hits the same way as a ramp. So you do have to be careful because the speeds are totally different. Because I see racers go real fast at ramps and I'm like, no, it's different. It's a different thing.
There's a technique to it for sure. Like, how did you, go from just like playing around to really perfecting your technique in it? Did you have people that worked with you or was it just kind of trial and error?
Yeah, trial and error. I mean, when I got into it, it was 2000, 2001 was my first show. So in New Jersey, who am I going to ask really? So I basically built my own ramp and then just started waiting for videos or magazines to come out and then being like, oh, I'm going to try to do that. So it was just a gradual, process. Obviously, once you get to backflips, it's you have to incorporate a foam pit or nowadays an airbag, which we didn't have. So you really had to find your way into a foam pit, which initially I did start learning at Travis's was the first place that I started flipping. And then I realized that there was way too much pressure having the greatest freestyle motocross and just motocross rider watch you.
Yeah.
And they're not easy on anyone. No one's easy on anyone there. You know, yeah. He was like, what's your goal today? And I'm like, I'm going to land on my wheels all day in the pit. And he goes, well, you should pick a goal that's attainable. And I was like, thank you for the confidence, Travis. I appreciate that.
I don't know if I've ever actually met Travis Pastrana, but he is for sure one of my idols. And I think just from all the media interactions that I've seen with him, actually, I did get to meet him. I met him at the AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame banquet last year.
Oh, when he was inducted, right?
Yeah, yeah. I did get to meet him and get my picture with him. And he just seems like such a down-to-earth guy, no matter who he's talking to.
I tell people that all the time. The guy that you see on TV with the thumbs up and smiling, and that's him all the time. That's literally how he is. He had already won a 125 championship by the time I met him. Like, he had no reason to be nice to me, but he always was. So,
yeah.
And then I think his brain processes stuff at a faster rate than the rest of us peasants, because the stuff he figures out in the timeline that he figures it out. That 720 thing, when I was there, he was trying that. And he's like, tries it like five times. And he goes, why can't I get this? And I was like, because it's impossible. Like, I don't know what you're trying to do here. And the fact you're amazed that you can't figure this out is blowing my mind.
It's crazy how the limits just continue to get pushed and pushed and pushed. And like you said, even like safety protocols for stunts and stuff has come a long way between foam pits and airbags and stuff that didn't really exist before. So it's always good to kind of see a little bit of safety being brought into something a little bit more dangerous or edgy.
Well, and that's the thing with our sport, right? I have had a conversation with some people where they were like, they think that the airbags are kind of killing freestyle a little bit because it's not death if you don't make it, which I think is a good thing, obviously.
Right?
But like, people are like, I guess that aspect is taken away a little bit. And I don't necessarily think that. I think it's that the tricks are so big, your average person can't relate to what's going on. So it's like almost above their head to even try to get into at this point. It could be a little bit of the airbags, but then again, in motocross, you know, they're not changing the courses. There's not really a way you couldn't put airbag landings in a supercross track, you know? So the protective equipment is coming along, which is good to see as well. You know, we all know the risks we take getting on motorcycles, but a little bit of extra safety is, you know, that goes a long way.
Yeah, accepting and then managing that risk for sure. Like, I'm a huge proponent of wearing all the gear all the time when I go out to ride. And I just can't imagine riding without it because I know what can happen. So, yeah, it's definitely important for me. And I'm glad that all of that stuff is kind of continuing to be, you know, developed and evaluated.
Absolutely. Especially helmets and even the older I get, which, because I was like a scatter shield chest protector kid, you know, which I still broke my back in it. And I guess because that was a compression, so you're not going to avoid that. But then I didn't wear chest protectors for a long time and none through my freestyle career. And now I'm like, the understuff that they force the, you know, in MXGP, they actually have a rule where they have to wear a certain level of body protection, which I think they should probably implement here as well. So that way at least people have their back covered and stuff like that. But the older I get, the more I'm like, I think those are a good idea.
Yeah, I know for the kids, the AMA did implement some rules regarding standard safety equipment for them. It hasn't made its way up to the adult ranks necessarily, but I think that's a good step in making sure kids are as safe as possible.
I agree. And that's weird coming from a kid that, you know, we didn't have bicycle helmets when I was a kid or mini bike helmets, any of that. We were just like, go for it.
So aside from freestyle riding, you have a few other podcasts. How did you get started in podcasting and what are those shows about?
So I've been hurt a bunch, obviously. And then the last time I got hurt in 2016 I broke my leg really bad racing a vet race at some tiny motocross track in the middle of Texas. And that's how I break my leg. And compound fracture. And I'm on crutches for like 6 months. And I basically just stopped booking any freestyle stuff and even shows for anybody else. I basically was like, how... I've spent all this time in the industry, you know, I can't just totally not do anything in it. So then I know that podcasts were obviously getting big. So I had started the Two Wheels to Freedom podcast, and that was basically me and a friend as a co-host. And then I would, you know, wrangle in FMX riders and interview them. When Nick and I decided to not do that show anymore, I started making the Clint Esposito show, because I started comedy in the interim as well. That way I could interview comedians and stunt people and all the other people that I know, so it's not just solely, you know, motorcycle related. And I have done some other ones with some other people. The comedy club I used to work at, we did the No Carnival Parking, which was they had a big sign that said No Carnival Parking. So then I'm like, this is what we have to name the show. So yeah, I've done some other ones. How about you? I know that you, is this your first podcast?
This is like the first official one of me hosting a podcast. I've been a guest on several of them, and I have forever wanted to start a podcast, and this opportunity came about and I was like, this sounds great. And the really cool part about this is that you and I just get to do the talking, and then there's a producer that gets to do the editing behind the scenes. And that was probably what I was most apprehensive about with wanting to start my own podcast, is, you know, keeping it low budget and having to do it all. So I'm pretty pumped that I can just focus on the interviews and getting to meet people and get to hang out and host a show.
You also teach dirt bike lessons as well, correct?
So this year is year 10 for teaching people how to ride street bikes in the state of Ohio. So that's actually done through the state and the Motorcycle Safety Foundation as well. There's a couple different curriculums that I teach. That's been really fun. Of course, I grew up dirt biking. I love dirt biking. And so I wanted an opportunity to be able to teach that as well. So I got my United States Motorcycle Coaching Association certification. Say that three times fast. That's quite a mouthful. USMCA certification a couple years ago. And I got certified to teach the MSF Dirt Bike School last year. So I will be teaching at a facility in Ohio and then also opening my own school this year, which I'm really excited about.
What is the MSF? Oh, obviously, I know of the USMCA because Fro is on it. So, of course, yeah. I know about that.
Yeah, the MSF is the Motorcycle Safety Foundation. So they have curriculum across the country, which is, you know, street bike curriculum, dirt bike curriculum. They even came out with an adventure riding curriculum. And then the state of Ohio also has its own proprietary curriculum called the MOR curriculum. So lots of different acronyms and curriculums to use. But the most important thing to me is that people are getting training, and it's an environment that is friendly and fun. And usually family or friends teaching each other doesn't result in good things. It's either yelling or screaming, or they just literally don't know how to teach them. And they just tell them to grab some throttle and into the tree they go, or crazy things happen.
I think you have issues on both sides of that spectrum, right? Because you know, anybody that you're too close with doesn't respect your word about, you could be a dietitian and tell them something and they're like, oh, you're my sister.
Yeah.
You know, like it totally is void. So you need somebody else to be like, I don't know what this person is actually like, so I'm going to trust that they're a professional and listen to them.
Yeah. And having like a curriculum with set steps and like building blocks is really helpful. And most individuals just aren't equipped with that knowledge. They learned how to ride 20 years ago and they just don't even remember how they got started. Or maybe it was a not great experience for them getting started. But having somebody actually with the skills to train you can be very important and helpful in getting started in riding.
Whenever I meet women usually and they're like, I hate motorcycles, I'm like, let me guess. You got on a bike for the first time on the back of one with some guy and he went really fast and scared you. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, these people are ruining motorcycling for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, I have control issues a little bit. Like I want to be the one
Yeah.
You know, riding the motorcycle, not necessarily riding passenger, or, although I have at times.
I would say that's from your experience in the motorcycling industry and seeing that stuff can go wrong and being like, I would at least rather be in control if something goes wrong than somebody else.
Yeah.
So do you go to any motorcycling events throughout the year?
We used to go to the Indianapolis Supercross for a lot of years. We haven't been in quite a while. I do feel like I'm always traveling and it's usually always motorcycle related. But a lot of it's like off-road dirt biking stuff. So I try to ride some local family enduros here in Ohio. And we go to Tennessee and Kentucky every year for the Land Between the Lakes 200 National Dual Sport, which those guys have actually become a client of mine. So that's super cool. I get to help promote their ride, and then I get to go down and enjoy it in beautiful area, Land Between the Lakes National Recreation Area. You only get to ride there once a year because they have a special permit to do so. It's not open to motorcycles at any other time. So it's pretty cool to get to ride some exclusive trails in that area. So that's kind of like the big trip every year. And then for my motorcycle safety teaching, there's an annual conference that moves around the country. And it's been in Idaho before. It was in Ohio last year. So that was kind of lame for me because I didn't actually get to go anywhere. But this year it's in Denver. So I'm hoping maybe we can take an extra week and do some riding out there.
So it's during the summer, obviously.
It is in September. So I think it should still be decent weather out there.
I don't know. Maybe. I feel like you're getting, and I could be wrong. I feel like in Colorado, you can get snow in the mountains and not necessarily get it at the lower elevations. Well, that would be fun anyway with a little bit of snow. You can't have too much, right? But if you were riding and there was a little bit of snow out, that would be
very scenic. If I had the right like heated gear and stuff, because I hate to be cold. So I'm not ashamed to admit that I'm mostly a fair weather rider.
Well, I turned into that too. I was going back and forth with somebody on the internet. And then I was like, well, hopefully it's warm enough for you to ride there. And they're like, huh, it's always riding weather. And I'm like, not when you've been doing it 45 years. Eventually you're like, guess what? I've ridden in this weather and it's riding, but.
Yeah. The only time I would say I would like take on not ideal weather intentionally is, you know, when racing or, you know, a championship's on the line or something and it's going to be really muddy and rainy and cold. It's like, but I got to go anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. As a kid, I didn't care. I'd watched the weather. And then eventually I was just like, we're racing anyway. I don't know why I'm watching the weather. I'll just wait and see what it's going to be like, you know? So, but yeah, I've become more of a fair weather rider than I used to be. I used to be hardcore. I rode a show. This is a side tidbit for you. I rode a show at a casino and they were supposed to be able to fit the ramps inside this little, I don't know what it was, like some little performance area room or something. And my ramp wouldn't fit in there. They told me it was 10 foot and it was not, it was 9'8". So I couldn't get the ramp in. So then we jump outside. This is Mississippi in January. We jump outside. It's 6 degrees in Mississippi. Hey. And then your body's not even fast enough to do any tricks like before you're landing. It was terrible.
Your like fingers are frozen.
Yeah. I would never ride an electric bike just because there's nowhere to warm my hands, you know?
Yeah. I went out for a street/adventure ride last Sunday, ironically. And granted, it just snowed yesterday. So here in Ohio, it's been swinging between 70 to 30 degrees every single week, like the start of the week's 30, the end of the week's 70. So I got out for a ride last week and I have heated grips on my 690 Enduro and it wasn't that cold, but I still enjoyed them.
Yeah. When I go to the shop and I drive my boss's truck and he has the heated steering wheel, you know, like I'm not mad about it. I'm like, this is pretty sweet.
And I don't have a very big windshield on my 690, which I've seen some different kits and stuff you could put on them. So that might be happening in the future.
So is that the KTM adventure bike?
Yeah, it's the KTM 690 Enduro. So it's more like a dirt bike than adventure bike. I mean, it's kind of the cross in between.
What's the adventure? Like a 900 or something?
They have, you know, the 790 and 890 adventure all the way up to the 1290 adventure. But those are a lot bigger bikes. And I'm 5'6", and I like to relatively touch most of the time when I'm riding. So kind of the smaller bikes and making some modifications.
Like a longer linkage or shorter, whichever one makes the bike shorter.
Yeah, there's a whole lowering kit, I think, in both of my bikes. And I'm really lucky, too, with my dad owning the shop and my fiance does suspension in the motorcycle and ATV industry, that I kind of have those experts at my fingertips.
You're dialed. I do now have a Harley, a 2015 XG 750, which is, so Evil jumped an XR, and then the XG is the road version of the XR. But somebody had bought this bike and then had the motor like tuned up or made to a race motor. So I have a dyno. So I kind of lucked out getting that. And I jump it. So I took CRF 450 front end, the whole thing, lowered the forks, I don't remember, 3 or 4 inches, and then slapped them. I had to get a new stem made. And then put them on the Harley. So I'm just getting them made stiffer so it can handle the 500-pound motorcycle I mounted them on.
Nice. I would say most of my bikes are relatively stock, although I am kind of getting the urge to start adding stuff to them lately. And maybe that's because they're paid for now. So I just feel like I got to spend money somehow. But there are so many options out there.
You're used to it. So now you want a little bit more power, whatever. What is the upgrade you want to do? Hotter grips?
No, maybe a new seat for the 690 Enduro, which that sounds really lame, but I mean, it could be a little more comfortable. I have a seat concept seat on my 250 free ride that I have for off-road, and that makes dual sports and stuff a lot more enjoyable. The windshield upgrade, that would be nice.
I want to get my front brakes to work correctly on the Harley so I can stop faster. And
yeah, critical pieces.
Yeah. So when I first got it, there were no front brakes on it at all because, like I said, it was for flat track. So there was just nothing. And I jumped it like that. And I love front brakes, which I knew prior to this, but it just reinforced it. And I'm like, you don't realize how much you use your front brake, even to just push your bike around.
Yeah.
And like stand there and hold it or like anything. You're just like on the front brake all the time.
I've heard some really crazy comments from students in some of my motorcycle classes about which brakes you should use or not use or how to apply them. I mean, some really wild things that family members or the internet has taught them that are very inaccurate. So we get to clear that up to start, that like we should never use this brake or we should only use this brake. Like actually, there's two brakes for a reason and you're supposed to use them both. So
at the same time.
Yeah.
I tell people all the time, you can only use your front brake as hard as you're on the back brake.
I mean, I see all kinds of things, but the cool thing is we get to work through that and like they leave with better skills is the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's street or dirt, right? I mean, like we talked about earlier, motorcycles are dangerous enough as it is. So if we can get you some better technique, like Rhino says, right? Technique is number one. And then that's how you're safe. We got to give everybody a good foundation that wants to get into motorcycling and take it seriously.
Yeah. I'm really excited for the upcoming shows and getting to interview people. I'm excited to kind of see who we're going to interview from the different segments of the industry, whether it's, you know, mechanics, whether it's racers, whether it's freelance writers. There's so many different segments of this industry. It's crazy. Thanks for hanging out with me today, and I'm looking forward to our podcast and seeing who we interview next.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to hopefully set a little base for everybody, at least of our personalities and a little bit of our background. We justified to you guys that we're allowed to talk about motorcycles, hopefully, and then you guys will tune back in to see what else we have to say. Thank you, Heather. Thank you, everybody, for taking us on. I'm very excited about the opportunity. And like you said, let's see where it goes.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They were able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.